this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com, and on the line with me today is Tom Kalopoulos, who is the founder of Delphi Group, a 20-year-old Boston-based thought leadership firm providing advice on leading-edge technologies to global 2,000 organizations and government. He's a futurist and been named one of the industry's most influential information management consultants by Information Week magazine. He appears frequently in national and international print and broadcast media such as Business Week, The Wall Street Journal, Forbes, The Economist, CNBC, CNN, NPR, and he's also an author and has written 7 books, including Smart Sourcing, Corporate Instinct, Smart Companies, Smart Tools, and the X Economy. And Tom Peters, one of my heroes, has called his writing a brilliant vision of where we must take our enterprises to survive and thrive. And Peter Drucker, one of my other heroes, says about Tom's writing, makes you question not only the way you run your business, but the way you run yourself. And today I'm going to be talking with Tom about innovation and teams and the relationship between the two. So, Tom, welcome to the call.
Well, Tom, thank you so much. That was a wonderful introduction. I'm going to capture that, send the link to my folks so that my mother and father can hear that.
Well, I kind of want to get people to understand that you've been around this idea of innovation for a long time, and you speak on it, including at places like you're a guest lecturer at Boston University School of Management and Harvard University, so you know a thing or two about innovation. So first of all, help our listeners understand why, if they're working with teams or leading teams, why they need to be focusing or at least paying attention to innovation.
That's a great place to start. I think that I would pick up on what you said at the very outset, Tom, which is that not only have I been around the block when it comes to innovation, but I think we all have. And we should all be very suspect and skeptical when someone comes to us and says, I'm going to teach you how to innovate. Because we're wired as human beings to innovate. And if any of your listeners have kids or grandkids or nieces or nephews, if they take a look at them, especially before the age of 6 or 7, they are born innovators. That is the human condition. I think what's happened lately, and when I say lately, it really is the past 10 to 20 years, Tom, such pressure has been put on us to not only team, but to team exceptionally and to really rise to the occasion and become not just the sort of basic team that we've all been accustomed to participating in our organizations, but to become truly exceptional teams and team members. And I think that is something that we weren't necessarily trained to do. At least I wasn't when I was a kid, when I went through grade school and high school and college even. No one taught me how to be an exceptional team player. And I think a lot of the discussion today around innovation really focuses on how do you create those extraordinary teams. Where I think we go astray, and your question was a real good one to start off with, is that we too often confuse innovation with rampant invention. And anyone who is listening to this who flies periodically and looks through the SkyMall catalog that is always in the seat back pocket in front of you right. knows exactly what I mean when I say rampant invention. We invent things just because we can, not because they have any utility or real purpose in life. My daughter, who's only 12 years old, a few days ago, was looking through a catalog, and she found a gadget. I don't even recall what it was, but it was one of these useless gadgets. And she looked at it, and she said, you know, Dad, why is it that people try to sell something that no one wants to buy? How perceptive. This is a 12-year-old.
No kidding.
I think a lot of what we do, and I say this a bit tongue-in-cheek, but I think there's a lot of truth to it, is we measure innovation by how quickly we can move product from the shelf to the landfill. And the quicker we can do that, the more stuff we can throw away, the more innovative we become. I don't think that's what innovation is about. Innovation is about creating value. It's about doing something that truly is going to enhance the human condition, the organizational condition, that will somehow add value to our lives. If we use that as our compass setting for innovation, I think we're going in the right direction.
So innovation isn't about creating something that you can hold in your hand?
Absolutely not. I think we've become very, very accustomed to innovation as being the iPod or the latest cell phone or some other sort of gadget that happens to catch our fancy. but it's not necessarily tactile. Innovation can take many different forms, and sometimes those forms are a pure service, a change in behavior, a change in the way that we approach a problem. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a product, something that you can hold in your hand.
So what happens if teams that are innovative and figure out ways to become more innovative, and what happens to teams that struggle with innovation and really don't pay much attention to it?
Well, that is the competitive mandate, I think, of the century. As I travel around the world, one of the things that I look at very closely are the differences in how cultures approach teamwork. And we often talk about the impact of culture on teamwork, but I think we do it far too parochially. We do it within the context of a single nation. I like to look at it in terms of how we do it across nations, across broad geographies, and real cultural divides. And what I have found, Tom, and I see more of this the more that I travel, is that there are certain distinct advantages that every culture has in how they team. I think here within the U.S. we have some very strong foundational aspects of teamwork that we need to reemphasize, focus on, and truly understand if we're going to become players and compete. And that really is the nature of your question. How do we compete based on teamwork on a mm-hmm. global platform? I'll tell you one that will probably surprise a lot of folks who are listening in on this. Our school system, especially K-12, it takes a lot of abuse, I think, from people who are very critical of the way we approach education here in the U.S. But let me give you one thing that we do in the U.S. that I see very few other cultures doing, and I do think gives our teams an advantage, and that is that we give kids the license to fail. There is something about failure which good teams are able to embrace. If you look at great sports teams, if you look at great organizational teams, these are teams that have succeeded because of failure. They've been able to bulldoze their way through failure. They haven't had a fear of failure, and they've made it through to the other side. And that's when they become visible, when they make it to the other side. No one sees all the failure. What we see is a success. I think we breed lack of fear of failure, if you will, into our kids, and that's a good thing.
Really?
Kids who grow up in the U.S. are entrepreneurs because it's okay for them to fail. And part of that is the culture we've developed where everyone has to become a winner. And I hear a lot of parents complaining about this and saying, well, every team has to win and we don't keep score, and we sometimes, tongue-in-cheek, become a bit disparaging of that. But I think it's a strength. Good teams need to know how to fail, embrace it, and get through it.
Now, speaking of education and where innovation comes from, I remember listening to an interview that you did, and one person said that at age five, if we take a group of kids and say, essentially ask the question, how many people here are innovative and creative? And a large percentage will raise their hand, and then at age 25, 20 years later, and you ask the same question, a small percentage will raise their hand. What's going on?
We are educating innovation out of our kids. I started by telling you what the positive was in terms of what we do well in our school system, but we have to have a balanced view here. I think at the same time, because of standardized testing, because of the tremendous pressure put on our school system and our teachers, because of large classroom sizes, lack of resources, they have to teach to the test. And what that creates is a mindset that there is one answer for every question. If anything has been proven incorrect in the history of mankind, it is that there is one answer to every question. Sometimes we need to reconsider the question and whether it's the right one. You mentioned Peter Drucker. I had a wonderful relationship over many years with Peter, and he still is. He passed away several years ago, as many of you know. He still is, in my mind, one of the icons of 20th century management. He defined the field. The most relevant question that he ever asked, and he would do this to me repeatedly, and he would do it very politely and very cordially. He would say, Tom, I think you're asking the wrong question. And I think the problem with education, Tom, is that we teach kids that there's one question and there's one answer, and that is not the way of the world. That's not the way that innovators think. Innovators challenge the question, and they constantly challenge the answer. Nothing is gospel. And there's something comfortable, sacred, very reassuring in one question for every answer. But uncertainty demands that we look at it a little differently. And the more uncertain the world gets, the more we're going to wake up to the realization that there are many ways to answer the same question. And sometimes the question itself isn't valid. We got to teach that to kids. But, boy, what a tough job for teachers to do. I mean, I have to empathize with them. It is the hardest job in the world, and it's very difficult when you've got a classroom full of kids and you're trying to teach to all levels and all skill sets. But it is a challenge that we have to rise to and become better at.
So I have two questions here. One is how do you then teach this 25-year-old or 50-year-old how to become more innovative? But I'd like to take a step back and have you answer this question before, and that is, what is the payoff? And in other words, is the payoff big enough? Is there a big enough payoff for us or the listener to focus on trying to teach innovation? Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so what is the payoff, and then how do you get there?
Right. Well, the payoff is the iPod. The payoff is Microsoft's new Surface-based operating system. The payoff is the shift from Electrolux to Aeris, the tremendous change in Electrolux when they completely reinvented their brand. The change for Herman Miller is in going from cubicles to their new Resolve, very human-based workspace system. The payoff for innovation is enormous. I think many of your listeners are probably familiar with the book Blue Ocean Strategy. Wonderful book. I think the fundamental premise that I walked away with, and we all need to appreciate fully, is that there are many markets, many opportunities that we have not even considered creating. And as we put technology into the hands of more people globally, as we hopefully create a more level playing field economically globally, then these markets will begin to emerge out of the ether. There are things that we can't even begin to contemplate that we have not yet innovated or created that will have enormous impact and payoff for humanity. So that's the payback for innovation. In a tactical sense, however, and a lot of this gets tactical, all this is nuts and bolts, I love to join hands and sing kumbaya like everyone else does. But at the end of the day, most of us work in organizations, with organizations, and we've got to make things happen at ground zero. The payoff at ground zero is that you create a culture that is constantly refining and creating new value. And that's really the chemistry today. Shareholders are looking for continuous value. They're relentless. They should be. They are constantly looking for how an organization can improve not only its profitability, but its perceived value to the marketplace. And you can't do that just by cutting costs, Tom. You have to create value constantly. You have to sustain that. And your last best idea has a shorter and shorter lifespan. And folks like Apple have conditioned us to believe that you can, in fact, come back over and over again and create new value. New players like Google are showing us that in the digital world, value creation can be limitless, or at least the perception is that it can be limitless. But that's good enough for me for the time being. We need role models like that that can illustrate to us that you can sustain value creation. And that's what good teams do. Good teams continue to raise the bar. No matter how high it has been, they continue to raise it further and further.
So when you share this that vision of what innovation is, kind of this continuous creation, do you ever look out into the audience and see people going, essentially, that sounds exhausting? You know, that
it is exhausting. It is exhausting. And I do. And your question is a good one, because I'll tell you the answer is absolutely yes. Every time I do this, I see the looks on the faces. But I have to share with you, and I hope this doesn't come across as too blunt of a statement, but I'm on the other side of the generational divide as well. And if I'm speaking to anyone, I'm speaking to myself as much as I am to many of your listeners. Those faces often follow the demographics of the audience in terms of age. It is those that are on my side of 30 that look at it and say, boy, that's a lot of work. The younger kids that I look at, they brim with enthusiasm.
Really?
They see this and they think to themselves, I can create. I can be a creator.
Yes.
Nothing is off limits because everything has not been created. We grew up, I grew up, in an era where I think many of us felt there was huge opportunity for invention and for creation. And I think then as we got a bit older, we started to develop this perverse sense that most of the good things really had already been created, and we just needed to refine them. When I was a kid, I used to think to myself, boy, what's left to create? The light bulb's been created, the radio player's been created, the phonograph's been created. What's left to create? I think that this goes in cycles, Tom, and I think we're entering an era now where once again kids are looking around and saying to themselves, it's a wide open green field of opportunity. And I think a lot of us that are a bit older don't quite buy into that yet, and we don't see the value in what's been created. And if your listeners are challenging me on this idea, what I challenge them to do is to look at the way kids behave in terms of text messaging, in terms of technology. I would bet that they look at that and say, where's the value? Those kids should do it the way that we do it. And that's just not the way life is, Tom. These kids are creating a new culture, a new behavior, and it will be part of the way that they behave and create value in teams. It won't be the way we did it. It won't be on the IBM Selectric or even on the keyboard of the computer. It'll be vastly different, and we have to begin to embrace that change as part of the way that teams are evolving, and ultimately the part of the way that, that we will create new value.
So so that is the payoff, which is, it sounds huge, and there's so many challenges that are facing us. I mean, I think about the innovation of, you know, an oil-based economy. You know, what happens if China, I was talking with a friend the other day, what happens if China figures out some other fuel, a way to, you know, move their vehicles around that doesn't, you know, requires maybe a fraction of the oil that they're using now? What would that do to us, you know, in our economy, and if they were able to beat us to that arena? But so there's lots of areas. How do we teach innovation? And I think there's another piece in here when you talk about generations is and teamwork, is that it seems like the Generation Y or Millennial generation, the generation that follows X, is more inclined, like you said, to enjoy innovation or brim with like this idea, and are more inclined to work in teams. But how do we really tap into that?
Well, I think part of tapping into it is generational, and I think part of the difficulty in the workforce today is that in any company you probably have four generations working shoulder to shoulder. That's quite different than the kind of workforce that we grew up in. So having four, maybe even five generations working shoulder to shoulder in one organization really does stretch the, and create a lot of tension, I think, generationally, and stretch the ability of many teams to operate effectively. Because even within close proximity, in terms of generations, if I email a millennial, they won't email me back. They want a text message.
Right.
So, you know, the fundamental precepts and building blocks of communication are being stressed just within the separation of one generation, much less three, four, or five. So I think a lot of it comes down to the actual tools that we use to communicate. And what I often encourage people to do within an organizational setting is to make sure that they have somewhat standardized on the rules of engagement for communication, so that they don't have different altitudes of communication going on where discussions are isolated one from the other because of the tools, if nothing else. And we've got to acknowledge that at the end of the day, the tools play a very important role in how we communicate. If I write a letter to someone as opposed to an email, it carries one connotation depending on the generation that you're in. If I send a text mail, it carries another connotation. And you got to be very careful because someone who is in the letter demographic may look at a text mail and dismiss it as being unimportant, whereas exactly the opposite might happen with a millennial. So I think these are the very practical sides of how we build teams and how we organize them and how we execute that really stand in our way. I will share with you one thing, though, which fascinates me. I went back over the last century as I was doing some research for my current book, and I looked at the Nobel Prize, and I wanted to understand how teams impacted the physical sciences. Would you believe that if we take 1950 as sort of the cutoff point, before 1950, the vast majority of Nobel Prizes awarded in the physical sciences were awarded to individuals, very few to teams. Roll the clock forward. Post-1950, vast majority to teams and fewer to individuals. I would speculate that as we go forward to the next 50 years, virtually all innovation in the physical sciences will be the result of teamwork. The problems are just too complex.
Interesting.
The networks are too expansive. No single person has the answers. We cannot innovate without teams, and that sounds like a real stake in the ground, but it should be. I believe that without teams, you simply cannot achieve the kind of levels of innovation you need to compete in today's and tomorrow's market.
So when you look at a team, if you were to say, come in and work with a team within an organization, let's say 3M, and they say, Tom, we want to become more innovative, and they have this desire to be more innovative, what are some concrete steps that they can take? I hear one of the things that you say is get better at your communication. That's a concrete step.
Absolutely.
What else?
There are, I think, one of the things that every company has to do is to set a baseline of tools, techniques, and methods that their company can use when it comes time to innovate, and then to use those tools and techniques regularly. And here's what I mean. If you ask most folks, how do you innovate? Give me a tool that you use to innovate.
Mm-hmm.
They'll come up dry. A few folks will come up with brainstorming predominantly.
Mm-hmm.
Some might come up with a few other techniques they've used or learned over the course of their career. But it's rare that you find an abundance of these tools. On the other hand, if you ask someone what tool do you use on your desktop to manage your finances, they'll come up with half a dozen different tools that they use.
Right, right.
So my point is, here's something which we all acknowledge is very important to our survival, to our competitive stature, to our global stature, and yet we have nothing in our portfolio to address it, or relatively nothing, other than brainstorming.
Mm-hmm.
So there are tools that organizations can acquire, and what's important is that when they do acquire them, they use them regularly. They become part of the way that they manage a meeting.
Can you give an example of these tools?
Some of the tools that I've been teaching and I've become aware of are specifically tools for creative problem solving. So there's one tool that I often use with many of my clients. It's called a morphological matrix. And this is a very old tool, by the way. It goes back to the early part of the 19th century. Been used extensively in engineering. I see it being used much more today in business. Very simple tool. What it does is it asks you to take a particular problem, maybe a market problem that you're facing or an opportunity, and define the dimensions of that problem, the attributes of the problem. It then will force you to randomly recouple, reconnect those different attributes in a way that you could not have predicted, and to then, based on that recoupling of those attributes, come up with a solution to the market problem. It sounds very simple, doesn't it? It doesn't sound like something that would be rocket science, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
When I've used this with organizations, it is incredible how many ideas they can come up with in a very short period of time to problems that they've probably faced for many, many years. And the magic in this particular tool is that it will randomize the way that you look at the market. And that really is what great companies do. Great companies take unexpected, unanticipated opportunities, and they respond to them very quickly. And this tool conditions you to be able to do that. And
so
that's just one example.
And this is a tool that you could use with an individual or a group of people?
Absolutely. You can use it with an individual or a group. It works best with a group of people because, again, it's the team dynamic that allows you to really create the richness of the problem statement. What are the attributes? What are the dimensions of the problem? How do we experience that problem? In a team setting, you're likely to get a much broader, much better sense for what the problem really is. I think the challenge when any of us face a creative problem-solving exercise is that we're limited to our own bias, our own parochial interests, our own experience, and it's difficult for us to challenge that adequately. And that's the beauty of a team. A team should constantly challenge what is parochial, what is expected, what is there because of experience, and identify new experiences.
And what happens if someone on the team or a group of people on the team say, well, you know, I'm not very innovative, I'm not creative, why don't we give that to those guys who are always coming up with the great ideas?
I think people are innovative in different ways. I don't like to hear someone say, I'm not innovative, or I'm not creative, because, as I said at the very beginning of our conversation, that is the human condition. We are all innovative, but we're innovative in different ways. Sometimes you'll find folks in a large group who are very quiet, who don't contribute at all, and others might get the impression that they're not creative, that they're not spontaneous, that they're not innovative. It just might be that that person is a very internal individual, and they're being incredibly innovative in their own head, but they just don't know how to share it with others. So I think what we see are differences in style, differences in the way we approach a problem, perhaps. Some of us are more analytical. Some are more right brain than left brain.
Mm-hmm.
But we're all innovative. We're innovative in different ways. And good innovation requires building a chemistry of those people. And one of the other tools that I often recommend to folks is that they do some sort of an assessment on creative problem-solving styles so that they can, in fact, identify what the right chemistry is for a team. You don't want a bunch of folks who are purely operational dealing with innovation. At the same time, you don't want a bunch of radical free thinkers because they'll never get the job done. They'll always enjoy the free thinking aspect of it and never actually get to commercialization. So innovation is a life cycle, and at different points in the life cycle, you need different skills and capabilities, but it's all innovation. That entire life cycle is innovation.
So what I hear you saying is that I can only imagine you walking into an organization and talking about innovation and people looking at you saying or thinking in their mind that this is going to change our culture. And that seems like I'm going to guess that you might have to push upstream, or there's just we've always done things a certain way, and now Tom's coming in talking about these, you know, that we've got to create these systems, and it probably sounds like more work initially. And I've even heard you say that innovation is inherently dangerous. Innovation is always the enemy. Innovation is an outsider. And so here you come in saying these things, and I got to guess that people think, how are we going to change our culture?
Well, let me give you a quick analogy. Let's say that you're cruising along in a big, beautiful, comfortable ocean liner,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly you hit an iceberg. What's going to cause you to get into the lifeboat is not the comfort of the lifeboat. It's the fear of staying on the ocean liner.
Right.
And I think what is forcing companies right now to consider something that might radically change their culture, that might be disruptive, that might create fear and trepidation on the part of individuals,
mm-hmm.
is the fact that they've hit an iceberg.
Mm.
There's no going around this thing. We can only go through it. And ultimately, if it's fear and crisis that drives us, so be it. I think much of human nature is driven by fear and crisis. I just hope the crisis is not big enough. You said a few minutes ago, as we were chatting, you were talking about what the world might look like going forward and how teams might help companies become more competitive. I want to roll the clock back for a minute. Go back 40 years. If I were to say to you, because you asked the question, what if China develops something in the future which weans them off of oil, where would that put us?
Mm-hmm.
And how will our teams respond? Well, let me roll the clock back 50 years. And I'm saying to you right now, Tom, 50 years ago, what if the Japanese build a car that's better than what Detroit can build? What if they create a car that most Americans would prefer to drive over a Detroit-built car? What would that make the world look like?
Mm.
Well, guess what? We just rolled the clock forward 50 years. You know what that experience feels like. So I we've hit an iceberg here. It's not as though we can sit around and rationalize and intellectually and academically have a discussion about this. We've got to get off the damn ocean liner, get in the lifeboats, and start rowing. And a lot of companies are being driven by a realization that they simply cannot retrench. If the U.S. economy hits a recession, and a lot of economists are telling us that it is, not that we should believe them all, but certainly the indicators are that we're in for a rough ride this year, at least so far.
Mm-hmm.
If we hit a recession, we can't afford to get in the bunkers because the rest of the world isn't in the same recession. Europe is going gangbusters. China is going gangbusters. India is seeing economic growth that's unprecedented. We can't afford to stick our heads in the sand. We have to continue to invest in innovation, continue to invest in excellence within our teams, and that's the only way that we're going to participate in this global marketplace. So, like it or not, I think it's fear and crisis that's driving a lot of organizations to embrace these ideas and to live through the short-term disruption that they might entail.
So when you get called by organizations, they're typically, they see this coming and they're afraid and they know they need to make a change. And so how fast can this happen? I mean, if your culture is not about innovation at all, or you're way on the other end of the spectrum, how fast can a group or an organization become what you would consider to be very innovative?
I would look at, there's a couple of ways to answer that. It depends a lot on the legacy of the organization, but I would use what has become the poster child lately for innovation in the consumer electronics space, and that's Apple. How long did it take with Apple? It's a very recent phenomenon.
Mm,
and
that's
what,
right.
really heartens a lot of people is when I tell them that the iPod was not an Apple invention, it was an Apple innovation, but it came to them from the outside. And it was presented to them originally by someone who had presented the same idea to virtually every other MP3.
No kidding.
That's right. Absolutely. And on my blog, on the innovationzone.blog, I talk about this, and I talk about in the new book, in the Innovation Zone book that will be coming out later this year. They didn't invent it. They innovated it.
Mm.
And they took it upon themselves to go after what they felt was a marketplace that for a long time they had no business in. That Sony had completely put handcuffs on. And yet today, I think nearly 40% of all music, and it may be more than that at this point, of all music bought is bought in pure digital form. How long does it take to change a market? As long as it takes one good idea to take root. And I think that's what companies have to embrace, is that the time will go by. Whether it's 4 years, 5 years, 10 years, the time is still going to go by. The question is, during that time, will you be rising to the mandate and the benchmark for innovation, or will you be sitting by and waiting for someone else to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a simple question for most folks to answer. If you're in business, it's unlikely that you want to sit by and let someone else teach you how to innovate. You've got to go out there. You've got to seek those ideas. And it can be done, Tom. I've seen companies do it, put in place systems by which to capture these ideas. Even Salesforce.com now has a component, an innovation management component, that allows you to, for $10, $15 a month, to put in place something that allows you to capture ideas. At least do that much. So my counsel to companies is don't sit still. Start doing something. Learn what it means to manage innovation. And in 5 to 10 years, I think it will become as much of a mandate in organizations as anything else we do today, simply to survive and to keep pace.
Okay, wrapping up, moving close to the end of the interview here, but I do know that you have an interest in education and innovation, and I want to put you in this scenario. You are now the education czar. What are three things that you would change in our education system, our elementary middle school, high school? What would you change in that arena? Three things that you think would help innovation.
If I was the education czar and I had the ability to do this unequivocally, I would make sure that every school system in the country had a program along the lines of Destination Imagination, a program that I've been very involved with now for many years, that purely teaches creative problem-solving skills to kids. I would make sure that program is not part of the classroom, but separate from the classroom and parallels the school curriculum so that it ties into somehow what the kids are learning in school. That's number one. Number two, I would make sure that every child has to take some course within the curriculum on creative problem solving, a mandatory course that talks about the tools and the techniques that can be used to solve problems in the real world. A simple thing, and I do it in K-12. I wouldn't wait until the kids get to college. I would do it as early as possible, and if we could do it before fifth grade, I think all the better. That's when kids really are shaped, is in that 5 to 10 year age range. The last thing I would do is make sure that I put as much effort as I can into balancing the standardized testing mania that has overcome us. I think we need somehow to reinforce with kids that creativity is different than test taking. And the SATs, the pre-SAT preparation, I see it now with my kids. They start at the age of 11 or 12 to prep for the SATs.
Mm-hmm.
I think is creating far too rigid of a culture. We need something to balance that. And I think universities need to look at how kids are able to deal with less structured problem sets, and we're not doing that with the current testing approach. That kind of a vehicle, I think, would give us a national mandate around creativity.
Mm.
In the same way that the SATs have given us a national mandate around test taking. Those are the three things that I would do, but there's so much more creative thinking that needs to go into that process. I just hope we apply ourselves to it and make it part of the agenda politically, educationally, socially over the next few years.
When I hear you talk, I think of John F. Kennedy, you know, putting forth the idea that we're going to be landing on the moon, and it sounds like what you would say is we need to land on innovation. We need to make that job one.
We've got to make it part of the discussion. It needs to be in our vernacular. It needs to be in our conversations. It has to be part of our agenda. And then I believe, and I say this parochially and I make no excuses for it, I believe the American people are driven by that level of challenge. The reason we put a man on the moon is because we set forth to do it as a national agenda item. I think we rise to the occasion when we see the crisis, and we've done this over and over again, but we have to keep the crisis firmly in mind. I think our attention span tends to be short for all of us, and we just need to keep it front and center.
So, Tom, help our listeners find out how to learn more about what you're doing. You've got a lot of books, and you've got some great websites.
Well, I'd love to have folks go to my blog, theinnovationzone.com. That's where most of my ideas end up, and most of the conversations I have with folks take place, theinnovationzone.com. And a lot of the programs I'm involved with educationally, the seminars, the summits, are all on my company site, DelphiGroup.com, D-E-L-P-H-I, DelphiGroup.com. We've got a number of events. I've got an innovation summit I'm doing at Babson College in March. I've got an innovation event in Scottsdale I'm doing in April. I have a master class that I do periodically as well. Lots of neat things going on there where I can meet folks face-to-face and get involved with them in the trenches, so to speak. So DelphiGroup.com and my blog, TheInnovationZone.com.
And you're just briefly talk about your latest book, Smart Sourcing. What is that about?
Smart Sourcing was a fascinating book. I had such fun writing it because it really is a look at how innovation is taking shape on a global scale. And it follows a lot of the thinking in Friedman's The World is Flat, but it's a much more nuts and bolts approach to how we create global teams and networks for innovation. And I think at the end of the day, Tom, this was really the conclusion in Smart Sourcing. At the end of the day, we will create societies and people who truly understand what their core competency is, what they do best. And if we could create a network, a supply chain, organizations where everyone knew what they were best at, every company, every person, I think we would have the most efficient, effective, and satisfied economy in the world. We're far from it today, but my challenge to everyone, when I talk to high school kids, to college kids, to professionals, to organizations, is make sure you define what you are absolutely best at and then pursue that as your passion, and that will make you untouchable. That will make you great. That, I think, is the benefit of globalization in the end.
Well, you mentioned Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat. I love that book. I think that it left me with the question of, so how do we do this? You know, what's the next step? And I think that's what I like most about your work and your approaches. What I'm hearing you say in Smart Sourcing is, here's what you do. Here's how you apply what Thomas Friedman is actually talking about.
Right.
So you don't get scared reading the book.
Well, Tom gave us the diagnosis, and what I'm trying to provide is the prescription.
A great metaphor, great metaphor. Well, Tom, you've been very kind. I appreciate your spending our time with for the interview.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, this is Tom Heck with TeachMeTeamwork.com, and I've been talking with Tom Kalopoulos of TheInnovationZone.com. Tom is, you can find on the web. He's got a great blog. He also has a internet radio program that's a must listen to. If you've enjoyed this recording, there's lots of other information that you can get off of his site that you can begin to apply right now. Whether you are a classroom teacher, whether you're running a nonprofit or a global organization, Tom has got some fantastic information that will help you stay competitive. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.